I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Regional Roundup. Ahead this hour, David Luis Suave Gonzalez was convicted of murder at age 17 and sentenced to life in prison in the late 80s. His story is now told in a new podcast called Suave. Also, we'll check in with the Enquirer's sports columnist Mike Sielski. March Madness is in full swing. But first, some good news. Relief will soon be on the way to local school districts struggling to pay the cost of the pandemic and reopen safely. President Biden's stimulus package, signed into law last week, provides billions of dollars in aid to schools across the country, with those located in high poverty areas receiving a greater share per child. So how will the windfall be spent? Recovery poses an enormous challenge. Two school years have been disrupted by the virus. Millions of children have lost ground academically, and some of them fell off the grid entirely when classes went virtual. Also, some urban districts like Philadelphia are facing issues that existed long before COVID-19 appeared, like the need to repair or replace aging, crumbling school buildings. Finally, decisions will have to be made fairly quickly. The stimulus money could disappear in just a couple years' time. WHYY's Avi Wolfman Aaron has been following this story, and he joins us now to take a close look at some of the particulars. Hi, Avi.
Hi, how you doing?
Well, thanks. So, you know, it's a happy problem to have for many administrators who are wondering how they were going to reopen school safely. If you would, Avi, give us a sense as to how much money might be flowing to Pennsylvania school districts overall.
So overall, we expect that Pennsylvania charter and school district schools will receive about $5 billion in federal stimulus that needs to be spent by basically October 1st, 2023. So it's over roughly a two-year time period, 2.5 years. And that $5 billion is mostly sort of like unspoken for. There are some carve-outs in there, but it's mostly sort of spend it how you want it money.
Wow. All right. And how does this compare to the earlier stimulus payments allotments of last year?
It's on a completely different scale. It's way, 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 way more money. So it's more than double the latest round, which was the December round, which was itself, I believe, about four times as large as the very, very first stimulus package that included some relief for schools. So this is on a scale that is just not even comparable to the stimulus that the school districts have already gotten. And, you know, I don't know if can say for sure it's the last round, but it seems like it for now, it's like the last big windfall for school districts.
Yeah. And so looking at Philly, what might the Philadelphia school district receive?
So the projections right now are a little north of $1 billion, about maybe $1.2, $1.3 billion, which is a humongous amount of money. Philadelphia, it should be noted, is way, 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 way larger than any other school district in the state. Like, there isn't one that's even relatively close. So that is why they take up a good chunk of the money. And the other reason why Philadelphia is getting a large chunk of the money is because a lot of the money is being distributed through a formula that sends disproportionately more money to school districts and schools serving students in poverty.
So, again, Avi, does the American Rescue Plan, the stimulus package, offer specific guidance as to how this money must be spent, or is it all should be spent at this point?
So it's pretty wide open. I should say there are like little carve-outs in there for private schools and homeless students, and like very, very small portions of the money. But the major sort of pot of money is given to school districts, and they're basically told you should use about a fifth of this at least for like learning recovery, but that's a really broad category. Yeah. And then the rest you can kind of do with it what you want.
The picture is certainly getting brighter regarding the pandemic, but of course we're not out of the woods yet. Are you hearing, Avi, that districts are considering still spending money, you know, on things like personal protective gear, sanitation, technologies for remote learning, that sort of thing, as we head into the summer, head toward the summer, and even looking ahead to the fall?
Yeah, absolutely. There will still be some level of mitigation, I believe, in effect, even into the fall. We could even still see some hybrid schooling situations in the fall, which means kids are part online, part in person. Part of the reason for that is that children will not be vaccinated. Maybe high school students will be vaccinated, or at least offered the vaccine by the time classes start back up again in August and September. But little kids will not be vaccinated. So there will still be some risk. There will still be people who can transmit. Obviously, the vaccines are not 100% effective. So, some small portion of teachers who've gotten the vaccine could still be vulnerable. So I think all that adds up to there will still be mitigation. There will still be things in place. Now, there's going to be a lot of debate between right now and then on basically like how much mitigation you need and how much space you need. So the standard has been 6 feet of space, for instance, between students. Some people have long argued that it only needs to be 3 feet of space. There's now actually an article just came out in the New York Times about a sort of a new emerging consensus and a new study by CDC scientists that suggest perhaps 3 feet should be the standard. And of course, by the time we get to September, depending on the state of the virus, maybe it'll be 3 feet, maybe it'll be less. I mean, it's a little unclear, but I think what's mostly clear is that there will still be money spent and time spent on mitigation.
Okay. Obviously with the pandemic, there has been enormous cost to the academic process itself. Some kids have done very well over the last year and a half, but many have struggled to keep up in a virtual learning environment. Describe the discussion around the enormous challenge of making up for lost time and helping these kids get up to speed academically.
Yeah, I mean, so this is the challenge facing school districts moving forward, right? So all the mitigation stuff, there's going to be a ton more debate about it, but, hopefully it will eventually recede into the background. The big question is then, where are students when they get back and how do we help them? I think what you'll see and what the big discussion is about right now is really not so much about the overall picture, but what the gap between or among students looks like. There's always gaps. There's always some kids who are ahead, some kids who are behind. But the suspicion is that those gaps will be even bigger because some kids were in such a disadvantaged place over the last year, and by the time you get back to, full school year and a half, that those students are going to need even more catch-up than normal. While some students might have even excelled and thrived in the virtual environment, will be even further ahead than we expect. So I think the big thing is, how do we get the help to the kids that need it? How do we really target it? And how do teachers handle a classroom where maybe kids in the same grade, at least nominally, are really, really far apart in terms of what they know and what they can do?
Does allocating money to remedial learning dovetail with the concept of stimulus spending? For instance, perhaps the district might be able to hire a whole bunch of teachers to help out those already in the classroom, teachers in the classroom. But if that money disappears in a couple of years, then where are they left?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And, generally, so the last time we had a lot of stimulus spending for schools was the 2009, sort of in the Great Recession, right? And at that time, we weren't dealing sort of explicitly with an educational crisis. It was just basically money to help school districts maintain their effort as they waited for tax revenue to rebound, more or less. And at the time, sort of the guidance was you could spend the money in ways that the money's going to expire. Don't sink it into a new program, like full day kindergarten or something like that, that you're just going to have to cut when the stimulus goes away. Or you'll struggle to maintain. And so this is a little bit different. I think there is a sense that you're going to need to hire people and staff. Maybe they're not full-time teachers. Maybe they're assistants, well-compensated assistants. But you're going to need to hire people, and you're going to need to start programs, tutoring programs, after-school programs, summer programs to help kids get caught up. Because this money is not just to plug a budget hole so that the school district can continue to do what it's doing. It's so school districts can do more to get kids caught up.
Yeah.
And so there's going to need to be real sort of careful messaging around we're starting something. We're probably not going to be able to do it in 3 years, but we're going to do it really intensely for a couple years, and we're going to bring people on and we're going to train them up to do this sort of temporary job. I mean, I think that's going to be a conversation that school districts are going to need to try to have with potential hires and with their communities.
Regardless, Avi, as you report, advocates and administrators hope this unusual stimulus provides a glimpse into another world, one where scarcity is not the ruling principle. So fair to say that Philly school administrators might be able to breathe easier over the next 2 years or so, and children might have a sense of what it's like to attend a wealthier district.
Yeah, I think I heard some people sort of express that sentiment to me, which is like, this is our shot to show what we could do if we were really sort of funded at the level we think we should be funded as a school district, right? And so by that, they meant, look, we can hire all the people we always wanted to hire. We can start the programs we always wanted to start. And we're going to show you that, you know, if you, the state or the city or whoever your funder is, actually fund us at this level consistently, look at what we can achieve. Look, there's many things that you can't fix overnight. For instance, facilities, you know, you can't snap your finger and have a new school. Yeah. But there are some things that, they, you know, a school district couldn't afford in the past. They're going to be able to afford now. And they're going to get a chance to prove that they can put that money to good use and really help kids. How they're going to prove that, I mean, you know, that's a whole other conversation. But that's, I think, when you're looking at sort of opportunities, silver linings, I think that's a lot of what the focus is going to be.
Well, Philadelphia's public schools certainly have some massive facilities needs. Remind us, Avi, of the situation here and whether there's any indication from the district that stimulus money can make a difference.
Yeah, so the school district has a tremendous amount of deferred maintenance, what they call deferred maintenance, which is basically stuff they need to do or they can't do. It's in the billions of dollars. You know, the last estimate was around $4.5 billion, but it's kind of constantly growing because the buildings are aging faster than they can fix them. And so, yeah, the stimulus money could be used to do some of that work. Now, that's not sort of explicitly about catching kids up, and so I think there'll be debate around, like, hey, should we be using this particular type of stimulus money to do construction projects, capital projects? But the argument for it would be that in the long term, if you do those types of projects, you can plug some sort of structural budget hole that allow you to spend more money on programs and things in the future because you're able to pay for things now, not take on debt, and, you know, put kids in better, you know, cleaner learning environments. And so I think there's going to be a lot of debate around, you know, how much of this money, whether in Philadelphia or elsewhere, there's plenty of other school districts that have aging facilities, should be used for buildings as opposed to, like, educational programs.
All right. Well, to be continued, and I'm sure we'll hear more from you on this as the story unfolds, Avi. But before we wrap up the first segment here, you've also reported on the effort to get Philly's educators vaccinated by early April. How's that going?
So the last update we got is that it's going. They sent out 35,000 invites to educators. And I should say educators here includes K-12, teachers in all sectors, private, public, charter, and also childcare professionals. And so they sent out 35,000 invitations, 20,000 people accepted. We were told, we had not gotten an update since the weekend, but that over the weekend, basically, this would be complete. All 20,000 will have gotten their first dose. And then sort of, you know, be moving through the second doses over the next 3 weeks. And so that's...
We're moving ahead.
Where we are right now, moving ahead. Exactly.
Avi Wolfman-Aaron, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Avi Wolfman-Aaron reports on education and other issues for WHYY. Coming up, we learn about a new podcast called Suave. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We're going to talk now about a compelling new podcast series produced by Futuro Studios and PRX. Suave tells the story of an unusual relationship between a journalist and a source who was incarcerated and later freed from Graterford Prison. David Luis Suave Gonzalez was convicted in the late 1980s of first-degree murder in the shooting of 13-year-old Danny Martinez. Suave was 17 years old at the time and later sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. At Graterford, he was among the largest population of juvenile lifers in the country. A few years later, journalist Maria Hinojosa spoke at a graduation ceremony at Greaterford. The two eventually spoke, and over the decades, interviews, correspondence, phone calls, and visits ensued, continuing through a 2016 Supreme Court decision which offered the potential for reprieve for many who'd been sentenced to life as juveniles. Their relationship continues to this day. We are joined by the three people central to this podcast. Maggie Freeling is host and a producer of Suave. Good to have you with us, Maggie.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Also, we welcome journalist Maria Hinojosa. She's anchor and executive producer of Latino USA and, of course, the journalist featured on the Suave podcast. Hi, Maria.
Hey, good morning, Philly.
Good morning. And David Luis Suave Gonzalez is, of course, the subject of Suave and also a Philadelphia artist with the Morton Contemporary Art Gallery and community activist. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Good morning, Philadelphia.
So let's start with a basic question. Maggie Freeling, again, you are the host of the podcast. What prompted the decision to tell Suave's story?
Well, so I've known Maria since probably 2015, and she had always wanted to tell Suave's story. And I think for quite a while, you know, myself and some of her producers were just, we didn't know what it was. But Maria kept pushing. And then finally, when Suave got out, thanks to the new laws passed about mandatory sentencing and juvenile lifers, we realized that there was a story that we did have to tell. And that story was, you know, not only as a man who thought he was going to die inside of prison, out now, but what happens when you do get out and the lack of resources that really are provided in so many ways.
Maria, let's go back a number of decades. Do you remember your impression of Suave when you first spoke or corresponded so many years ago? And did you envision this long reporter source kind of friend relationship happening?
I mean, look, I got to be honest with you. Suave was a kid. He was a kid. He was in his 20s when I meet him in 1993. I mean, to have a kid basically look at you and say, I'm going to be in here for life. I mean, if that doesn't touch your heart in a way or make you feel something, you know, I don't know. So I was just like, whoa. And also Suave was very clear because I live in New York. I'm in Harlem right now. He was like, yo, I'm from New York, you know. And so I was like, okay, there's a connection there. Also, Suave didn't ask me to work on his case. A lot of the other guys did. And Suave was just like, look, I'm going to be here. Like, what do I do? And that's when I said, well, look, be my source. Tell me what's happening inside, you know, one of the largest maximum security men's prisons in the country, in the state of, based in the state of Pennsylvania. Tell me what's going on. So, of course, I never forgot. Soon after that, I decided to do a story for NPR. I was a correspondent. And I decided to do a story about jail, prison as a rite of passage. And I decide to go back to Greaterford. And that's when I meet Suave again. And it's like, hey, you know, now I'm interviewing you. And then I start sending him Christmas cards because the
Christmas
truth is
cards.
I knew where he was going to be.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like the kid was going to be in there for life. Yeah. And I knew people who had been in prison close to me. And I don't know if I saw it as like a ploy, you know, let me just send. No, it was like, God, I don't know if this kid will ever get a Christmas card, but I've talked to him about my family and he met my husband in Greaterford and we send Christmas cards with photographs. And so that was one of the things that kept us in touch. And no, I never imagined that Suave would get out, much less that we would be doing a podcast that is really gathering a lot of attention.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary story. Suave, let's go to you. Again, as a very young man, you walked through the doors of Greaterford Prison. And at one point, you told Maria that the concept of a life sentence of incarceration didn't mean anything at the time. What was that like?
I mean, as a child coming into the state prison system, I really didn't understand what was going on. I didn't understand when the judge told me you are sentenced to life. You know, to me that meant nothing because I was illiterate. I didn't understand the law. I had no idea that life meant life, death by incarceration in the state of Pennsylvania. And fast forward to 1993, I meet Maria, and to that point, nobody in my life have ever told me you could be the voice for the voiceless. No, everybody in my life to that point was like, you're not going to be nothing. You're serving life. You know, and growing up as a kid in the Latino culture, it was norm to tell your kids, like, you're not going to be nothing. You're going to be like your daddy. Well, I believe that. So I meet Maria in 1993. She told me you could be the voice for the voiceless, and I still didn't understand it. You know, it took an incident in the prison for me to understand what was happening. And it took almost 10 years after I was sentenced to life for me to understand that I was going to die in prison.
So, Ave, you say that you had to prepare for street war in Greaterford at all times. Get into that a bit for us.
Yeah, because at that time, Greaterford was one of the most dangerous penitentiary in the state and the sixth largest penitentiary in the United States. So you go in Greaterford, it was like a street mentality. It was the street wall. The same people you met in the corner down North Philly that were up in Greaterford. The only difference now is that in Greaterford, you can't run from a problem. You have to address it. And most problems at that time in Greaterford prison were addressed with violence. So, you know, I was exposed to a lot of things. I did a lot of things that I didn't want to do, but I had to survive as a kid. I had to survive.
You, and again, you were there for decades, and if we have time, we'll get into the incident that you know, sent you, I guess, to Greaterford, for lack of a better way to put it. But let's take a listen first to the opening moments in the first part of the podcast series, again called Suave. And then this took place after you'd been released.
What's going on? Just talk to me. Suave, I'm talking to you. What is going on?
I'm cool.
Suave, forget that Maggie's in the room. Forget that
I'm
Maggie
cool,
is...
I'm cool. I'm serious. I'm cool. I'm just...
Yeah, but just tell me what just happened.
I never thought I'd be locked up in a room like this again. I'm cool.
I know you're cool, sweetie. You're out of prison.
I just had a little flashback.
Okay.
It's just like, it's too real.
So, Maria, where were you when that Suave felt as if you were having a flashback?
Well, Suave was coming to my office, I think for the first time, and we were in our little compact studio. I mean, it's like that build a studio kind of thing. and so it's like a closet. It's dark. It's black. It's like 6 feet by 4 feet. And I couldn't believe what was happening. You know, we walk into the studio. This is a studio where I received many of Suave's phone calls. I would record them. I'd jump in there. So I had cried in the studio talking to Suave. I'd been excited in that studio talking to Suave. And all of a sudden, Suave walks in, and he just, his body just, like, starts to contort. His face, you know, just gets, like, all red. And we couldn't tell what was happening. Was he laughing or crying? Because these kinds of reactions, you know, after you've been in prison for 31 years, it's hard to expect. You know, one of the things that Suave, we've talked about it even now, you know, for 31 years, he used a spoon to eat, one spoon that he would use and lick and put back into his pocket every single meal. Mm. No knife, no fork, one spoon that you lick. And he says, you know, now sometimes he'll go to it. Well, before the pandemic, he would go to a restaurant and all of a sudden he'd be walking out with a spoon. he didn't mean to, but it's like, and that kind, I mean, we can laugh about it. Thank God. It's not funny, though. It is the institutionalization and the dehumanization that we get at with the story of Suave in the podcast.
Maria, you said that at times you cried in the studio while you were speaking with Suave. What were some of the things that he told you as a news source that moved you to tears?
The time that I remember Suave saying something that really shook me was when he said, that Mexicans and Spanish-speaking people in Greaterford prison were, and I'm going to use a term, I'm sorry, this is could be interpreted as a slur. Hmm. He said they are now the new blacks in the prison. And Suave started crying because he was witnessing what had happened, which was the poorest, most vulnerable, who didn't have documents, who didn't speak English, were being abused the way black prisoners once had been abused. Because remember, prisons
were at
the
bottom. At the bottom,
right?
Rung.
Because prisons used to be majority white, you know.
Yeah.
And then the prison industrial complex, et cetera, et cetera. So, and then there was, you know, the moment when Suave, you know, so fast forward, you know, years later, Suave is telling me about getting the news that he is no longer on a life sentence, and that he has a date, and that, you know, he's going to come out. I mean, I just, you know, I remember just like in tears, just out of happiness. And that, as Maggie, myself, Julieta Martinelli, the other producer, and, you know, we talked about it. It's like, if you don't have those sentiments as a journalist after being in touch with someone for over 25 years, well, entonces qué? What kind of a journalist are you? And I want to be the kind of journalist who is still and forever known as speaking from the heart, as a hard-edged journalist who will ask the toughest questions of everybody, including Suave, but pero de verdad que tengo corazón, that I also have a capacity to use humanity as a journalistic tool as well.
And to bring the story home. So, Suave, I'm going to get back to you in just a moment, but I'd like to bring Maggie into the conversation again. At age 17, Maggie, Suave took a deal to avoid the death penalty. Mm-hmm. What was the attitude around the prosecution of this sort of case back in the 1980s?
Wow. So that's something we really dove in when we started looking at Suave's files that he gave us. I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with Roger King. He was a prosecutor in Philadelphia who's now completely disgraced. He prosecuted Suave's case. He was the lead prosecutor. It was his office. And it really seemed like it was just this mentality of, you know, disposable black and brown youth. You know, whether you did this or not, we don't really care. We're putting you away. Which, you know, is really incredible to think about. And it still prevails today, but particularly in the 80s, particularly under Roger King, it was so egregious. And Suave got swept up in that, you know, disposability of black and brown bodies back then.
Suave, the shooting you were involved in when 13-year-old Danny Martinez died, again, in the late 80s, it happened at 8th and Somerset in North Philadelphia. You returned to that corner for the podcast. You call that moment, you know, it's either a fight or a botched robbery, depending on the telling. You call that moment the 15 seconds that changed your whole life. Talk about the 15 seconds that can happen to a young person who is caught up in the moment, for better or for worse.
I mean, when we returned to that corner, it was like I was reliving that night again. But it was needed for me because I wanted to connect with myself and really, you know, to honor my victim. And I want the youth to know that it only takes seconds for your life to change, you know, depending on how you read the files, you know. But I accept responsibility for what landed me in prison. And 15 seconds changed my whole life, not only my life, but it changed the life of everybody that was involved, whether they got caught or not. It changed the life of everybody because it had a ripple effect on my family, the victim's family, my community. And I needed to go there because I want the youth to understand that no matter what you do in life, whether you're guilty or not, it could only take seconds for your life to change. And my life changed in 15 seconds. 15 seconds, just turning the wrong corner from my house and ending up in 8th and Somerset changed my life.
The homicide rate remains horrendous in Philadelphia today. In your opinion, Suave, what needs to change so that lives are saved?
We need more people like Maria and Ahosa intervene in these young people's life. I truly believe that if I had somebody like Maria and Ahosa, anything in my life in the early 80s, I probably would have never been incarcerated. You know, we need to start motivating our kids. We need more school programs in the city of Philadelphia. We need more people to have compassion and empathy. Instead of just saying, lock them up, throw the key away, let's go deep into that child's life. You know, chances are, if you're coming out of North Philly, West Philly, South Philly, Southwest Philly, you are living some form of poverty. You are living in a household probably where the father and mother are either locked up or on drugs. I mean, this is the reality in Philadelphia. There's nothing in the city of Philadelphia for our young kids to get involved.
Maria,
there's nothing out there.
Points well made. Unfortunately, we only have like a minute and a half left of this segment. But Maria, as a journalist who is still following this story and still has a relationship with Suave today, what are your thoughts here?
Well, as a journalist, never give up. As a journalist, never give up and always be seeing that the story is right in front of you if you open your eyes. Again, we tell the story of Suave. We tell the story of his incarceration, his redemption, our relationship. But it's also about never giving up on a story. And I think it's also about shining the truth. The prison population is one of the fastest growing populations in our country. And right now, the intersection, by the way, you know, Greaterford closed down.
Yeah.
It was like out of Shawshank Redemption, over 100 years old. That Greaterford, that place, if I'm not mistaken, is now going to be opened up as an immigrant detention facility. Make the connections between the prison industrial complex, mass incarceration, and what made Suave cry when he was sentenced to life in prison. And he was crying about, you know, the most vulnerable, the undocumented, who are now going to be housed there and who are experiencing an entire other level of abuse. So there's so many stories. And I just want to say, you know, also dream. Suave had the capacity to dream this. And I had the capacity to keep on recording our phone calls and never give up. And Maggie had the capacity to say, okay, I'll take on this massive assignment. So it's a lot about saying yes. It's a lot about saying yes.
Maggie, we've got about 30 seconds left. What has the response been so far? And where can we find the podcast, Suave?
It's truly been incredible. Maria is a visionary. She knew this was going to be something when all of us, you know, again, I was doing this in 2015. We all just doubted. We didn't know what it was. And I think even now we're processing, you know, how incredible this story is that we have told by Maria and Suave.
So where can we find, I'm sorry, we're just about out of time.
Anywhere you get your podcast, you can find it.
There you go. Maggie Freeling, thank you so much. Marie Hinojosa, you as well. And Suave, best of luck to you. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. Up next, Philadelphia sports columnist Mike Sielski worked for The Enquirer. We're going to talk about March Madness and more. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, and this is the Regional Roundup. The NCAA tournament begins this week. No surprise, Villanova has punched its ticket to the dance. But for the first time in 25 years, the Drexel Dragons will take part in tournament play. And even though COVID was not able to trash the tournament as it did last year, there has been some notable effect in 2021. Duke won't be there because of a positive COVID test. And most games will be played in one town, Indianapolis. That said, there will be a limited number of fans allowed at games, and the same is happening in pro sports at the Wells Fargo Center, for instance, and Citizens Bank Park will be open to a modest number when the Phillies season gets underway next month. We'll be talking about all this, as well as some of the latest news from Phillies pro sports teams. Joel Embiid's knee, for instance, in the second half of the Sixers season. With Enquirer sports columnist Mike Sielski. Welcome back, Mike.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for having me.
So first, let's talk about Selection Sunday, which was yesterday, and Drexel, 16th seed, and again, first time in a quarter century, Drexel will be there. Mike, something to celebrate, but a tough game ahead on Friday.
Very tough game. They are 16th seed, which means they're playing a number one seed, and that number one seed is Illinois. Illinois is the Big Ten champion. The Big Ten is probably the best conference in the country this year.
Yeah.
So the Dragons are really going to have their work cut out for them. It's a heck of an achievement for that program to make the tournament. As you said, it had been a long time. But as I said, I think their stay in the tournament is probably going to be going to be short.
Pretty short, yeah.
Illinois is really good.
Yeah. And a quick note, too, I think the Drexel women's team also made it to the women's NCAA tournament. And I think the selection process is tonight for the women. And that's a big deal because I think it's the first time both teams on the Drexel campus have made it to the NCAA tournament at the same time. So
that's right, Mary. I think it's actually the first time it's happened in the city, in the Big Five, at least, you know, the Big Five and Drexel since about 1997. I think St. Joe's did it then. So heck of an accomplishment, really.
Yeah. All right. Well, on to Villanova, which is seeded fifth in the tournament. And I guess there's, you know, point guard Colin Gillespie will not be playing. And another tough match on Friday ahead for Villanova. I mean, will Philly sports fans be able to cheer beyyond the weekend?
Well, they're as a five seed, they're playing a 12-seeded Winthrop. Mm. And what's interesting about the tournament over time is that the 5-12 games tend to be upset heavy, meaning that the number 12 seed often wins those games. There's something about that alignment there that often leads to upsets. Now, having said that, even without Colin Gillespie, who, as you said, is their point guard, kind of the guy who orchestrates all their offense, you know, a big part of their last national championship team back in 2018, Villanova's always a tough out in the NCAA tournament, even when they lose. They're never an easy draw. And I'll say this: yesterday, when that matchup came up, if you were watching CBS or ESPN or any of the analysts, it became very popular to say, "Oh, Winthrop's going to beat Villanova, that upset."
Yeah.
Don't think for a second that Jay Wright, Villanova's coach, isn't using that as motivation and to his advantage with his kids.
Sure.
They got beaten in the Big East tournament by Georgetown. Georgetown had an incredible run. Villanova did not play that badly, so they could certainly survive to the round of 32. Whether they'll make it to the Sweet 16 is another matter entirely.
So, not to sound like a Philly pessimist, but who takes the whole thing, Mike? Do you think it might be Gonzaga? I know you wrote about them last week.
Yeah, you know, I would bet on Gonzaga. They're 26-0. They have a chance to go to be the first Division I team to go unbeaten since 1976 when Indiana did it. If you look at them statistically, they are so far ahead of everybody else in the country that it's really quite striking. And it seems, you know, we can get into, you know, why college basketball doesn't resonate around the country the way it once did. But Gonzaga is really good. Illinois is really good, as we mentioned before. And Michigan, who, has Phil Martelli, the former St. Joseph's head coach, as an assistant. Those would be probably the top three favorites, I would say.
All right. And of course, again, last year the tournament was just kind of nuked by COVID. Does COVID play a major hand here in the way this is played and in affecting and any teams in particular?
I don't know if it affects any team in particular. It'll be different in that all the teams are going to be in the same city. Usually they're kind of spread out to all the corners of the country for these games. But often in the early round games of previous year's tournaments, there aren't all that many fans in those games, particularly in the early afternoon games. It's hard for fan bases to travel often and things like that. So I would think that just from a spectator viewer perspective, things won't feel really different on the first Thursday and Friday of the tournament.
Okay.
And we'll see how things go from there.
All right. On to football. The NFL draft takes place, I think it's in Cleveland at the end of next month. Assuming, Mike, we're not going to be back virtually anyway in Commissioner Roger Goodell's basement?
I wouldn't think so. I think the entire country and all the football-loving public got enough of a look at Roger Goodell's basement. And
his wardrobe changes, yeah.
Nah, exactly. I think the NFL is going to do everything it can to have as much, if not all, of the draft in person, you know, as the country kind of slowly opens up here.
So Jalen Hurts was a 2020 second-round pick. Is he going to be the Eagles' starting quarterback this year?
I think he probably is. All the scuttlebutt and reporting that's being done about how the Eagles are approaching this draft, and in particular their first pick, the number 6 overall pick, suggests that they, and when I say they, I mean their owner, Jeffrey Lurie, wants Jalen Hurts to get a shot to win the job. And I think that's a pretty smart thing to do. I'm not a big advocate of allocating huge amounts of resources to the quarterback position anymore. I think there are so many good ones out there and there are so many good ones available that you can find one without having to use a high draft pick on one. And the Eagles have so many other needs from wide receiver to linebacker, offensive line, you know, you name it, they have a need there. So I would be surprised if they use their first pick on a quarterback.
So if Jalen Hurts starts, who's the backup?
Well, they're probably going to end up signing a veteran backup. You know, who that is remains to be seen. I think we've got to sit back here and kind of wait to see who else might get released. You know, as the teams try to get their salary caps in order, it's one of the fun times in the NFL is this time of year, because teams try to clean up the contracts that are on their books, and they get into some creative financing to push money forward or give, you know, players more money right away so they can get rid of them faster. So I think the Eagles will end up signing a veteran to back Hurts up and kind of lend him support and advice and all those things you want from a backup quarterback.
Okay. As you reported last week, Dak Prescott has been signed to a 4-year contract extension with the Cowboys, which could top out at $160 million. If he's fully healthy after that horrendous compound fracture and ankle dislocation he suffered last fall, what does this mean for the Eagles and the rest of the at times truly terrible NFC East?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I mean, number one, as you said, you have the question of whether Dak is going to come back fully healthy from what was a pretty ghastly injury.
Yeah.
That's number one. Number two is that the Cowboys really gave Dak a terrific contract. And in a couple of years, he's going to be counting, what, as much as $40, $44 million against the salary cap for their team. Now, if you're a quarterback who's as good as, say, Patrick Mahomes or Tom Brady or Aaron Rodgers, that's a good thing for a team. You know, obviously, you're a great player. They've got you locked up. You're the kind of quarterback who can carry a team to a Super Bowl. Dak Prescott's a very good quarterback. I think the question for the Cowboys and the rest of the teams in the NFC East, the Eagles included, is whether the Cowboys are allocating so much money to a good quarterback, not necessarily a great one. Maybe he could become one, but we don't know that yet. Are the Cowboys going to be able to allocate enough resources to all the other positions around Dak Prescott to make them good enough to win a division or even challenge for a Super Bowl? I think that's an open question.
All right. Washington football team came out on top in the NFC East last year with a 7-9 record. Where are they with a name?
That's a really good question. I'm not sure that they are anywhere with a name. You know, it's they had a number of candidates, so to speak, kind of thrown around last year. The Washington Warriors, the Washington Red Tails, I believe, was one, you know, in a nod to the Tuskegee Airmen.
Okay.
You know, it's what's interesting is if you're really cynical about this, you could argue that their owner, Daniel Snyder, doesn't want to give them an official name because he can keep selling the merchandise from the old team and the old name. So
why would we be cynical, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we'll see what happens with as far as the Washington franchise goes.
All right, and the Sixers, they've done really well so far. Still atop of the Eastern Conference in the NBA, but Mike, the schedule is said to be grueling in the second half, and Joel Embiid, of course, out with an injury that could have been a lot worse. I think he's got a bone bruise in his left knee. What do they need to do to stay on top?
Well, they've got to keep getting play like they got last night from their two other stars, Ben Simmons and Tobias Harris. They invested a lot of money in those two guys. You know, we've seen a lot of growth in Tobias Harris's game this year. He probably should have been on the Eastern Conference All-Star team. He had played for Doc Rivers, the Sixers coach, when they were both in Los Angeles with the Clippers, and Harris had the best seasons of his career then. So you're seeing something similar play out now. They're a much better kind of aligned and set up sort of team for the way the NBA is played now. They have more outside shooters. They probably, if there were a way for them to gain or acquire another offensive player, they would probably like to do that, but they're playing so well right now that I would be surprised if they made a big trade. I think they're going to try to ride this out until Embiid comes back, and I think they feel pretty good about their chances.
Rivers hired as head coach last fall. How has he impacted the Sixers?
Giving them credibility, you know, I mean, Brett Brown, you know, did a very nice job here for a long time, but it was a first time head coach in the NBA, and Doc Rivers had won a championship with the Celtics. Yeah. He's been one of the top coaches in this league for a long time. And nowadays among professional athletes of all sports, credibility in a coach is coin of the realm.
All right. To the Flyers, Alain Vigneault's Flyers, they're in the middle of the pack of the NHL East. Tough year for phenom goalie Carter Hart, who, you know, 22 years old. What should we expect of Hart, Mike? At that age, life in the big leagues can be so challenging. I mean, there's just enormous, enormous pressure. And if you get into a dry spell, it's hard to pull yourself out of it.
You're right, Mary. And what's interesting about Hart's situation is that he was kind of weaned on pressure hockey, even as a young player. He came up, he was a phenom in Canada. He's played internationally, world juniors. You would have thought, I think, that he would have avoided a slump like this, where he's really kind of questioning himself, doubting himself a little bit. But this is something that young goaltenders in the NHL go through. The guy who was the kind of the standard bearer for the last 10 or 12 years in the league, Carey Price from the Montreal Canadiens, went through something similar in his first or second year in the league. He played a playoff series against the Flyers back in 2008. He was so bad, it looked like he was carrying the weight of the world in his goaltending catching mitt. It just was really tough to watch. And he's come around and been, as I said, one of the best goaltenders in the league for a long time. So I think the Flyers are committed to Hart. They're going to hope that he kind of pulls out of this because they need him.
Phillies had a 60-game COVID schedule last year, back to normal this year. I think it's, 162 games. How are they shaping up ahead of opening day, April 1st, at home against the Braves? How have they been doing in spring play?
They've looked pretty good in spring training. They have, obviously, an interesting and controversial situation in center field.
Yes.
Because Odubel Herrera is back and playing very well after having faced domestic violence charges a couple of years ago. You know, I would say right now he's the leading candidate to be their starting center fielder, which, you know, as I said, is interesting on multiple levels.
Yeah.
I would be optimistic about their chances this year, because the primary reason they missed the playoffs last year and had such a disappointing season was that they had the worst bullpen in all of Major League Baseball. And it's impossible for that bullpen to be as bad this year as it was last year. And it really was the only reason that they didn't qualify for postseason play. So if they're even moderately better amongst their relief pitchers, I think they're going to compete for a playoff spot.
So back to Herrera, he did apologize to the clubhouse. If he does make the opening day roster, Mike, there will be some pushback. How does the organization handle this?
You know, it's really interesting, Mary. All the reading and research I've done on this suggests that one of the worst things that you can do if you are paying mind to the victim or alleged victim in a domestic violence situation, one of the worst things you can do is be extremely punitive toward the attacker or the alleged attacker. And I think the Phillies tried to handle this with as much sensitivity to the alleged victim as they could, to Herrera's girlfriend. There's going to be pushback. They have to know that. Everybody knows that. I think it's merely a matter of Herrera, you know, continuing to show that he's somehow a changed man. You know, it's a really fraught topic. You know, I don't blame anyone for how they come down on it, but it's a really tough situation.
Okay. Quickly, a collective cheer went up when JT Realmuto was re-signed to a 5-year deal as catcher. What does that mean to the Philly squad?
Well, it means they've got the best catcher in baseball for right now. Now, whether Realmuto is still the best catcher in baseball at the end of that contract, we will see. Catchers tend to have a pretty short lifespan at the top of their profession. It's such a grueling position. But he is the best defensive catcher in baseball. He's the best offensive catcher in baseball. He's a leader in that team. Bryce Harper wanted him re-signed, and Bryce Harper got what he wanted. So they better make the most of it in the next year or two.
He made that clear. Mr. Harper did.
Sure did.
So, listen, we've got about 45 seconds left. Are you excited for the 2021 Tokyo Olympics, which, Mike, I understand will still be referred to as the 2020 Olympics?
I am. I'm excited, Mary. I'm excited for anything that inches us closer to back to where we used to be. I really am. I mean, I think, you know, for so many reasons, this was just an awful, awful year. And I think one of the smaller reasons it was awful was that because sports wasn't around, sports is one of the very few things we have in society anymore. It's not the most important thing, but it's one of the few things that draws connections among people of different backgrounds, races, creeds, et cetera. And I think getting that back to normal and feeling normal and regular again, and the Olympics are part of that, is nothing but a good thing.
And we'll see how that plays out, because they're still working on protocols. And it's not clear as to whether athletes will have to be vaccinated. So that's a story we will be following. And I guess we're up against the clock. Mike Sielski, always great to catch up with you.
Thank you, Mary.
Mike Sielski is sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Don't forget, we are on social media at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our rebroadcast airs at 11 tonight. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producer, John Ahrens, with help from Debbie Builder. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks for joining us. Be well.